You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.
Today on our show, I'm talking with Melissa Stern. I'm talking to her from New York City. Melissa, thanks so much for being with me today.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be on your show.
Well, Melissa, let's talk about what you're working on now. I imagine it's a number of things, but whatever it is you're working on in your studio, can you tell me a little bit about that?
Sure. I am actually about to have a solo show open in New York City. It opens on May 3rd and a gallery on the Lower East Side. And the show is called You're Soaking in It. And I'm going to totally date myself and maybe some of your listeners. The title refers to a 27-year advertising campaign. Do you know this slogan at all? Is it familiar
to you?
You're
soaking in it. You're soaking in it?
Yeah.
I don't.
Okay. So in the, 70s, they started when women were going into the workplace and kind of trying to do it all. They started an advertising campaign for a dishwashing soap that was so mild that you could be a working woman and wash dishes and take care of your family and do all that and have a manicure using the dishwashing soap.
That sounds very 70s, that's for sure.
Right. It was really iconic, and there was like this young woman in a business suit, you know, rushing home to take care of her husband and child, or just her husband. And, you know, she's at the manicure parlor, and this kind of grizzled old character actress would say, you know, honey, you're soaking in it. And it's iconic in that, you know, it was a kind of part of a whole time. And it ran for 27 years, which is a long time, and for an advertising campaign. And I'm very enamored of words and slogans that have double meanings. And so the idea of you're soaking in it, and my artist statement for this show is, you know, we're all soaking in it. This kind of, overall sense of soaking in something. I'm not sure what. So the work is mostly assemblage in the old-fashioned sense of the term, like Marisol used to make. And so it's a combination of pieces that are on the wall and then coming off the wall into your space, so working in this play between two and three dimensions. And I work in...
And what gallery is that you're having the show in?
Oh, I'm sorry, I have to do the plug. Right, it's called Station Independent Projects, and it's 138 Eldridge Street, right below Delancey, on the fashionable Lower East Side of Manhattan.
That is a very fashionable place, and that's run by Leah Oates, isn't it?
That's correct. Yes, it is.
She's a wonderful person and a good friend of mine.
Yeah,
so that's nice
world.
To hear. So tell me a little bit about how you approach your work in the show, because your work, you say assemblage in the old, you know, fashion sense of it, combining materials, but your work also has a look that almost, forgive me for saying this, if this is not how it fits to you, but that almost looks like folk art or outsider art or visionary art or art brut or all of those things. So maybe if you can describe what some of the works look like in that show and whether what I'm saying even fits or not.
Well, it does, and that's something I've heard a lot. And the fact is that I think I'm a contemporary artist who works in that tradition. And if you look at my resume, my background is in anthropology. And what I studied is why people make things. And so I've always been really interested in the power of objects and the power that an object can have to move you and move you enough to want to spend money to live with it even. And so I'm interested in objects that trigger memory and trigger narrative and storytelling. I have a large project that is traveling around to museums around the country. It's been traveling for 5 years, called the Talking Cure Project. And it's me collaborating with 12 writers and 12 actors. And it's about storytelling and memory and narrative. So
let's talk a little bit about that project as well. I mean, don't let me interrupt you, but if you're relating it to what you're doing right now, keep on with that, but yeah,
no,
I'd like
totally.
To talk about
totally,
that project as well.
Totally relates. So, you know, because I make pieces that are, they're narrative, but they are awfully, often kind of an abstracted narrative. I mean, what I'm interested in is telling a short story, but leaving the ending open so that you, the viewer, can bring your own ending to the story. I'm really interested in what other people have to think and say. I'm interested in your story, more than mine. So throughout my career, besides people commenting that the work looks, you know, self-taught or visionary, that sort of thing, people have always said to me, what's it mean? What's it all about? And I found myself asking that kind of classic therapist question, you know, what do you think it means? And I began to get more and more interested in other people's stories. So I made 12 sculptures, and I invited 12 writers from all different walks of the writing world. I have a comic book artist, a rock star, a playwright, a poet, you know, you name it. And I invited each one to come into the studio by themselves and write a 3-minute monologue of what they thought my sculpture was thinking. And then I cast that project with 12 professional actors, and they were given the monologues and asked to summon up that character. You know, who is that? Is that a male or a female or old or young? And those monologues were recorded and put up in a cloud somewhere, and we generated, or someone else generated, QR codes, those little black and white codes that you sometimes see in stores. And so in the exhibition, when you point your phone at the QR code, it triggers the audio and the sculpture speaks. And along with that project is a book, and it is literally a talking book in that it has the written monologues and has photographs, but when you point your phone at the book speaks to you. It triggers the audio.
I love that.
It's really
I love
cool.
that. Okay, so to talk about that a little bit and in combination with the show, because now that's exciting that the show is coming up and we're talking now and that you're really explaining how dynamic and interactive it is.
Yeah.
That project, you know, sounds like something that's time consuming, that requires funding. So to talk a little bit about how all this is supported, is it through sales? Is there other things you do? Is it volunteers? How does funding come together for something like the project you're doing?
That is such a great question, because I learn by the seat of my pants, which is frankly how I do most things. So I'm happy to let other people learn from my mistakes. The book, which is a really gorgeous art book, professionally produced, was done through a Kickstarter campaign. Very simple, very direct. I did crowdsource funding in order to do a really professional book. So the book is sold in museum gift shops wherever the show goes. So I also am very interested in souvenirs, which is part of what my new work is about. And so the book acts as a souvenir, if you will, of the experience. So I did the book through a Kickstarter. The sculptures I just made because I make work. You know, it's just nobody funds me. It's funded through whatever sales I do, or I teach. I'm an adjunct professor at, I've taught at School of Visual Arts and NYU and other places. And I also write about art for an online blogazine called Hyperallergic, which you may have heard of. So I do other things to help support my studio practice. The Talking Cure really took on a life of its own, and it started out as a selling show. I had a show in Seattle and was hoping to sell the work, and nothing sold. And ultimately, to cut a long story short, I rebooted it as a museum show and enlisted the help of some professional advice from some dealers that I know about how one places shows in museums. There is no rental fee for this show. The museums pay for the transport, they pay for the insurance, they pay for all the ancillary costs of installation, you know, all that sort of thing, and they have to pay for me to come out and do a project with the community, because I'm very, very interested in this project as it relates to everything from school children to retired people. And so there's a school curriculum that travels with the show that an institution can use, or in some places, for example, at the Akron Art Museum, the Kent State Creative Writing Program used my show as a jumping-off point for working with their students. But for every venue, I come for a day or a couple of days and work with some variety, some part of the community, whatever the museum wants. In Charleston, South Carolina, I worked with the entire sixth grade of the Charleston School for the Arts, which was just wonderful to work with kids, you know, who are, I guess, 12 or 13 years old, and hear their take on the project and talk to them. So the show kind of, it needs minimal funding, and that funding comes from the institution. Because of the nature of the exhibition, institutions have been able to partner up with other venues and institutions in their area. For example, the show is right now at the Wiseman Art Museum in Minneapolis, and Wiseman Art Museum has partnered up with a children's hospital. And so they're doing a project with the siblings of young cancer patients, and using my project as a jumping-off point to talk about your feelings and your memories. And so other institutions join in. So it's become collaborative in a really large sense, which is incredible, just so exciting for me.
That is really exciting. So to talk a little bit about some of those, how that happens, are you now reaching, do you reach out to institutions and also tell them about this program and what's possible, from children to museums to adults, or are they all reaching out to you now, or is it a combination of both?
Some combination of things. I have someone who helps me kind of handle the booking and business details of it. So he handles all the legwork kind of thing. But I was on South Carolina Public Radio. I was part of the Spoleto Music Festival. It was the featured art exhibition. So, you know, using the media and word of mouth, it's picked up its own steam and has its own reputation, which has just been marvelous.
That is marvelous. And what will come out of this? Will there be another book? And I'd like to even talk a little bit about how it works with children briefly. But as this grows, will you simply have more exhibitions, and the kind of exhibitions are interactive and talking, so to speak, or will the other elements come out of it?
Well, there has been a request by a theatrical producer to turn this into an immersive theater project, which would be an amazing iteration of it. So a play treatment has been written of the project by a playwright and a director, so that may bounce off on its own. I have no plans to do a second part, although I've been asked repeatedly if I would do the Talking Cure Project Part 2. You know, it is what it is. It's very complete and fully realized. It will continue to travel at some point. I would love it if somebody would like to buy it or buy parts of it. There are 12 drawings and 12 sculptures that all travel together. Nothing is for sale, obviously, while it's traveling. So at some point, I feel like it will have its own logical end. But right now, it seems to be bustling along, you know, full tilt boogie, which is very exciting. And I have a proposal out to do another project also involving the community and storytelling and an interactive component, working with a former NPR radio producer. And that project is about the notion of fairy tales and the stories that you remember from your childhood and how you retell them as an adult. So we'll see what happens. That one will definitely need a little funding.
That's exciting. So let's just to walk through one of them. It could be one that's upcoming, but just to be just to be clear to all the listeners about exactly how it works, the project travels to a particular place. Let's say there's a group of children, or as you said in, what was it, Wisconsin, or there was a student group that's using it, Minneapolis.
Minneapolis.
So how does it actually work when it gets to Minneapolis? What happens?
Well, you know, in Minneapolis, the Wiseman Art Museum is on the University of Minneapolis campus. So they scheduled me to do quite a few projects with students. I worked with a first-year MFA student. I did a student interview with a young woman who was interested in learning, in writing about art, and so she interviewed me. We did a public forum talking about memory and art and theater. There's a big theatrical component of this project. So I work with an institution tailoring the community involvement with whatever will work for them. I let them take the lead, and I'm happy to slot in wherever I can help and whenever, whatever works best with their community. I'd have no dictation about this. So it evolves and changes in every single place that it goes, and the response has just been overwhelming and extraordinary. And I don't mean that in terms of, like, I'm a big art star, but it just touches me so deeply that I have been able to make something that moves people and has caused them to tell their, or given voice for them to tell their own stories and their own narratives, and that it's had so much reverberation in the world. I never in my life imagined making something like this.
That's fantastic, because it sounds like it kind of organically grew into that. That isn't what you expected initially either.
Oh, totally. I was like, okay, I'm going to have a show. I'll sell a couple of sculptures, and then I'll move on to the next thing. And, you know, boom, I pivoted. I had to pivot because nothing sold. And it morphed into something completely unusual. And completely, certainly, out of my experience range. I did not start out as an installation artist or a, you know, community activist artist or someone that had that much interchange with the public. And now I love it. I hope to do another project. Now, this is all by way of saying my show in New York has nothing to do with any of this, except that the themes, and I mean, you would recognize it as my work. It's like handwriting. You would walk in and go, "Oh, I know who did that." But it's not.
So, but it does relate to it in the sense that some of what people have said is linked by the code you mentioned, the QR code to the pieces when you're in the gallery.
Well,
is that correct?
Yeah, it has to do with the Talking Cure project, in that I'm working with some of the same ideas and themes, and the idea of storytelling. The current show that is opening in New York does not have QR codes and does not have that kind of overarching theme and project. It really is more of a traditional, you know, show that is a group of pieces that are all grouped together thematically. And what I've done is the Talking Cure project has drawings that are very layered and rich and three-dimensional, with a lot of drawings underneath drawings and kind of ghostly images coming through. So I think of them as dimensional drawings. And the sculptures, which are made out of clay and wood and metal and found objects, all have drawing on them. So in a sense, they're three-dimensional drawings. The difference is that this new work that I'm doing really combines the two, in that the drawing, the two-dimensional and three-dimensional work is really all combined. So things are both flat and then they pop into dimension in the same piece. So it's been an artistic evolution. And thematically, I think I'm always still working with the same ideas and interested in memory and childhood and storytelling, and interested in what ideas I can provoke from the viewer. But certainly aesthetically, this is an evolution in what I figured out how to make.
I like that. I'm so glad we talked about that and the projects, and I'm excited to come see your show as well.
Thank you.
Before we go, I want to ask what books you're reading now. The question I ask everybody towards the end of this interview.
Very good question. I am a huge reader and a wildly, weirdly eclectic reader. I have two books going right now. One is a nonfiction book called The Man Who Tried to Save the World by Scott Anderson, which is a nonfiction book that is a kind of almost John le Carré story, a true story about an aid worker who disappeared into Chechnya and was a shadowy, interesting character that no one knew quite what he was. And it's wonderful, an absolutely amazing piece of journalism and reportage. And at the same time, I'm reading A Brief History of Seven Killings by Marlon James.
Melissa, thank you so much for talking with me today. It's really been a pleasure talking with you.
Oh, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure talking to you, and I hope to see you at the show in New York.
You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.